Talk given Friday, 15th August, 1975. How far do we let things take their natural course? This question has very deep implications . How far are we able to let things take their natural course? I think if we look really deeply into this, we shall see that human beings are great interferers with the course of things. We are supposed to live in a cosmos. But it would be rather difficult to find any living creatures, certainly, other than ourselves, who are such producers of chaos. Chaos in the sense of disorder. Let us feel this out very quietly, but very intensely. If we look at nature, the cosmos as we call it, in which we live, we see that every aspect of nature obeys the laws of its being. There are certain variations, of course. There are certain failures, of course. But it is hardly possible to find any kingdom of nature which deliberately interferes with the natural course of things. Contrast our human life and our human behavior with the life and behavior of other living creatures. We are driven by our desires. And our desires, on the whole, are very unintelligent. The natural urges, which are inevitably associated with the fact of possessing a living animal body, would take their own natural and proper course if our thought-out, conditioned, induced, enticed desires did not interfere with them. If such interference did not take place, we would live a very much more harmonious life than we do. But there is a terrible price we would pay for it. We would stick at the level of good animals. We would never have the conflicts, the stimuli, which draw, and the challenges which draw out something in us which needs drawing out. Man's brain, as we all know, has quite outrun all other aspects of him. Now, there's a very good reason for this. Man has to awaken to his withinness, not only as a self-conscious creature, but one who will use his power to look within in such a way that he balances his observation of that which he sees without, outside of him. If there is a balanced vision, the implication of that is that he has begun to understand, at least begun to understand, the trends of life for him. To put it in another form, he would begin to understand the purpose of his existence on the globe. And he would begin to develop himself in such a way that he would act in cooperation with the trends of life. If he can awake that way, he will see the necessity for disciplining all his urges and all his desires, which are conditioned and shaped by the socio-cultural environment and which are handed down to him through his socio-cultural heritage. Desire is the great driving energy in man. And this driving energy in man, which we call desire, human desire, is a power that takes him right beyond the restricted realm of living as a good animal. The animal is a good animal insofar as he, as a member of his particular herd or flock or whatever it may be, lives in accord with everyone else. Man has to become wholly individual, develop ego to its full point, ego in the right sense, develop it to its full point, see how egoism is the thing that spoils everything, and release himself from bondage to egoism. And then he will naturally live in harmony with his total environment. As and when he does that, he is at last the true individual, the indivisible, that means, whole human being. When he is like that, then he has completely ceased to be an interferer with the natural course of things, where his life as man in this world is concerned. And not only has he ceased to be an interferer, but he has become an active, deliberate cooperator with extraordinary power to enrich the whole of life, of everything on this planet, not only himself. Then he will be able to think rightly, to feel naturally and truly, he will be able to live physically, in the true sense of the word physically. Physical, derived from physis, meaning nature. He will live spontaneously and beautifully. But let us look at this business about thinking rightly. You know how all over the world this applies, east and west and north and south alike, everywhere it's the same. We have the admonition, think rightly, carefully, before acting, before doing. But what do we mean by thinking rightly before doing? All the world, with very, very few exceptions, regards this right thinking as that which will promote the fulfillment of his desires, his ambitions, what he calls his gifts, if he has any at all, and so forth. He means by such thinking the ability to steer rather close to the wind and escape the consequences of doing what society says he shouldn't do. He thinks he has got away with it. Very smart. He hasn't actually hurt anybody, he says. And therefore, he plays this cat and mouse game with life. That is something of the nature of what he means by it. And if he is, in the worldly sense, religiously inclined, if he's philanthropically inclined, if he's altruistic, and so forth, you will find that all those aspects, religion, altruism, philanthropy, and so forth, are still fully self-oriented. he has never actually got past the egoism of his egohood. Now that is the sort of thinking that he calls right thinking. We can be a little generous and say that he's concerned with the well-being and the welfare and the happiness of society, perhaps of all mankind in a general sense. He will say that. He will believe that quite sincerely. But does he understand what precisely is man's well-being and welfare? What the world has called welfare has, perhaps with no exceptions, proved ill-fare. Otherwise, after all these hundreds of thousands of years on the face of the globe, we wouldn't be in the state in which we are. So now, this right thinking, what lies at the root of right thinking? Let us inquire. What lies at the root of right thinking? What makes it possible for me to think rightly, for you to think rightly? Remember, what we call thinking is just silent chatter in the mind. The profound and deep meaning of thinking is creating, minding in the true sense, in the supreme sense. And that is associated with creation. If there is right-mindedness, a healthy, whole mind, then that person can think rightly. Because the silent chatter which goes on in his brain will be of a totally different quality and a completely different orientation from the chatter which goes on in the worldly-minded person. Completely different. He will no longer be self-concerned. He will no longer be the other person or society concerned. Because the worldly-minded person, the worldly-natured person, merely makes a distinction between self and not self. And when he says, I'm doing this for the sake of everybody else, what he actually means and what he actually does is also is self-oriented. He doesn't see it. Right-mindedness, which means that he himself, listen carefully, has no mind of his own. If he had a mind of his own, it means that all his mental activities are abstracted out of the universal activity of the divine mind, of the all mind, and therefore they obstruct the total reality. See, we have ideas about selfishness and unselfishness, and they are childish. If they were only childish, they wouldn't be so disastrous in their consequences as they actually are. They are the ideas of a sick and almost an evil mind. This right-minded condition, because of which right thinking emerges quite naturally, just as the bud becomes the flower quite naturally, granting that it's the soil, the plant is all right. Now, what is it? Let us put it this way. Which is the most powerful factor in our human lives for releasing the state of right-mindedness? Now you see where we are. This is the significance, the meaning, the importance, the indispensability of purity, pure morality. Consider now, who were those in the world's history who emphasized this indispensability first and foremost, and who were those who themselves embodied this purity? It was the great teachers, the great spiritual teachers, those who were not only wholly concerned with, but those who themselves were mighty forces for the salvation of mankind. Salvation meaning releasing mankind into that whole and healthy state so that man no longer interferes with the natural course of things. Now, if we understand this, we will understand why the bulk of their teaching centers round this teaching of purity of everyday life. In thought, feeling, speech, and action. We may say, but surely there are millions of us in the civilized world who are taught to live the virtuous life. Are we? Either our teachers have not been particularly successful, or we are extraordinarily inefficient, incapable learners. What is our morality? What is our virtue? See, this is where the practice of mindfulness is such a paramount necessity. We watch our, when we do practice mindfulness, we watch our, leave aside actions for the moment, because that is a much easier matter to deal with. We watch our thoughts and our feelings, and we are aware in terms of this is bad, this is evil, this is better, this is preferable. This is our reaction, is it not? So up to a point, we grow in relative virtue. But for every relative virtue that we have, the angel in our little heaven inside ourselves, we give birth simultaneously to a little devil who is hidden inside in the unconscious. Why is that? Because my observation is the observation of a person who, deep down in himself, is striving for self. It is this which is the big lord of hell who makes me an obstruction to the universal process without my knowing it. To awaken and be very clear-sighted with respect to this perpetual self-orientation is the supreme task involved in being a human being. A human being, in the true sense, is one who is virtue embodied, transcendent virtue embodied. He is naturally, divinely virtuous, absolutely so. There is no ambivalence, no conflict of virtue-vice, no judgment going on inside in his mindfulness that, this was good, and no, that was not so good. This ambivalent state is the state of the duality, which is perpetual bondage. You see, it is not an easy task. And when anyone comes along and says, 6 months course, you know, or perhaps a very intensive sit-in for 1 week, and we take you to nirvana, it would almost not be a crime to shoot them. These are the agents of the devil. They emphasize your self-orientation. They make it glow black hot with a black fire. So beware of that. Right-mindedness does not emerge that way. It is only the totality which is this isolatively self-conscious I am the obstruction to that totality, to the isness of that totality. The isness of that totality of transcendence is pure virtue, is pure mind, is perfect action, untrammeled by any of the criteria which we humans who live within duality and the conflict of duality try to impose. See, these are not easy things. But if once, even once, one really sort of gets a clearer glimpse, sees the flash straight, right in front of your eyes, then you will know always. That will never disappear from you. The knowledge will be there. And it is that kind of knowledge which is the power that releases insight. Insight into the true nature of things, of people, of situations, of ideas. That is the sort of person who has the jnana dassanam, the vision and knowledge. It's the other way around. Knowledge and vision, jnana is knowledge. Jnana dassanam, the knowledge and the vision that the Buddha talked of, for instance. So now, this purity must not be striven for as an attainment, as an achievement. Because attainment and achievement has no meaning whatsoever in the context of totality or of transcendence, or use any such word you like. It has meaning only in the context of separate selfhood, in the context of the sinful state. So all attainment, all achievement tends to emphasize the sinful state, the ill state, the evil state. All attainment and achievement in any sphere whatsoever, if it is felt and seen as attainment and achievement, is an interference with the natural course of things in relationship to the human kingdom, in relationship to humanity. We must really feel this with intensity, but complete inward poise. If there is the intensity and the inward poise, it means that our total mental activity is no longer directed towards ourselves. Nor is it directed towards what we call the not-self. Our total mental energy is now in harmony with the universal energy, the divine energy. And when that happens, oneself ceases to obstruct the natural course of things. And one is in the pure state. always try to see, to feel the reality and to feel that one is totally, wholly in the presence of the transcendent fact of any particular aspect of our lives. The transcendent fact of purity is the purity of the totality. And if one's awareness is in rhythm with that, it is that which does everything. Not I or you or this person or that person. I or you or any one person is now the unresisting medium, the awakened medium, not an unconscious, gone to sleep, good-for-nothing fellow. But the awakened medium, instrument, through which this power of transcendence works. You see, therefore, what sort of transformation takes place in each one of us ourselves and in the environment in consequence. I know how easy it is to ask, but I don't see the lives of saints and good men and so forth and capable people altering world conditions to this, that or the other extent. Yes, we don't see it perhaps. But is that any reason for saying that it is not there? If a man is born totally blind, will he ever see the difference sunshine makes to us on this planet? Do you think he'd be justified in saying that there is no such thing as the sunshine and it doesn't make any difference? It's a little bit like that. Look into this matter deeply, because this pure morality is the thing, the one thing that all the teachers emphasized above everything else. All the rest follows from it. When there is this natural and pure morality, and this naturalness depends upon the ability to see the nature, the true nature of what purity is, this is where the intelligence comes in. The brain comes in, you see. When this utterly natural and pure morality is there, then what happens to our desires? What we see and recognize as our desires are the patterns, the psychical shapes, forms, expressions of something which is deeper, namely desire energy. We may, just for convenience, quite impersonally, objectively, scientifically, say that desire energy in itself is simply the electrochemical energy of the living organism being cognized in this, that or the other shape because of the activity of the brain and the ductless glands interacting with the situation around. It's a convenient way of talking about it, that's all. But this desire energy is something which remains with us all our lifetime. If the electrochemistry of the body ceased, well, that's the finish. When the purity is there, then this energy, this desire energy, becomes an inexhaustible source of power for right action. Then my thinking or your thinking before doing this, that or the other is right thinking. And bear in mind, it will not be a copy of somebody else's thinking. This is very important. You know how all the world, especially the very sincere devotees in every faith, they say, our Lord thought like this, and because he spoke, he said these words, and he set this example, and I am trying to follow in the footsteps of the Lord. Won't do. Living organisms are not rubber stamp copies. Especially where human beings are concerned. We are unique creatures. And it can be said very truly that transcendence shows its extraordinary variety through the human kingdom more wonderfully than it can display it through the other kingdoms, at least on this planet. Each one of us is unique. And it is the immense, inexhaustible, creative variety of transcendence which shows itself through each and every single human being. Therefore, you and I can never be, should never try to be, rubber stamp copies of somebody else. Because if we try to do that, we may succeed up to a point in making ourselves in the image of somebody else. But that is not what is wanted by life. That is, life says, oh, this is a failure. Let's squash this fly. It's useless. You have to be yourself. And you are yourself by realizing the unself state, and let transcendence demonstrate the unique self, you. Transcendence is the artist, the sculptor. Let that come out. See where your desire energy comes in? You bend all your energies to allow the transcendent energy to work through you. That's the most extraordinary part of the whole thing. Do that and you will find that you have not, will not, and cannot interfere with the natural course of things. Look at it thus, which I've tried to present tonight, and you will see the real significance and the part played by morality, as we call it, purity, in the whole and the deepest sense of the word.